Thank you, Sandra. Well, this third lecture, we would like to, so we have been talking about condition, and we would like to come to an example and the use of condition on giving an algorithm and analyzing a certain problem. And we are going to come to a problem that has been actually the heart of Jean-Pierre's talk. Okay, so as you remember, the idea is we have, let me do a drawing. Here a system G, and here a system F. Okay? And let's assume we are given a zero zeta, so a point zeta such that G of zeta equals zero. Okay? And we want to compute a zero of F from the zero of G. So the idea is that we consider this straight line. Here you see I put different norms, this is the origin of coordinates, of G and F, so I am no longer in projective space. We will consider our systems in HD. Okay, the space HD. And the idea is, well, we move along this line of systems, and this zero will also move. So if we are here in Pn, and let me do the following drawing. Let me call this angle here alpha, and this fraction of angle is tau alpha, so that tau varies between 0 and 1. Here is tau equals 0, here is tau equals 1. I will do it here, but I wanted to do. And when tau varies between 0 and 1, we start here with zeta, and we somehow end up here with the zero we are looking for. Okay? So I'm very bad doing drawings. That's the reason I put the two spaces separately instead of doing beautiful pictures like Jean-Pierre, in which you have everything on one three-dimensional picture. So this is the idea. Now, one thing is, you remember we mentioned the mu norm of a system. Let's call this system Q, and a zero of this system. Well, actually, we don't need to be a zero of the system. If we have any point x, we can compute the mu norm of q and x. Well, if the derivative of q is not defined on x, then this is infinity. But otherwise, we can compute it. And the point is that, this is very important, we can use that to define an adaptive algorithm that follows this path. So if we call this system here q tau, so that q0 is g and q1 is f, the problem we find is, if we have a q tau, what would be the next q tau? What should be the next tau? And then the idea is that the next tau, let's call it tau prima, to fix idea, is roughly speaking tau plus a tiny constant, small constant, I don't know, 0.01, divided d to the 3 halves, and then comes the mu square norm of q tau, and zeta tau is the zero we are considering. Okay? This gives us an algorithm, a procedure. It's very important because otherwise we don't have any way to follow, real follow the zero. Okay? And the procedure, you notice that the length of the step depend on how well conditioned somehow, x tau, which is my approximation. Okay? Z tau will be my true zero, but my true zero, of course, I don't know it, but what I do have is an approximation of the true zero. So essentially, if this is that tau, here I have somehow approximating an x tau. Okay, so if we are interested, I will just leave this side of the board. From an algorithmic viewpoint, well, okay, we are interested now in how much does it cost me to follow this, how many steps I will have to do. Because you see the number of steps depends on how much do I advance at each step, and this depends on how big is this condition. In order to explain this, all the sort of results that one may get, I want to make a very, very simple comment. Both F and G can be either random or deterministic. Okay, and this gives us for some sort of table. Here is F, here is G, deterministic, random, deterministic, random, and we get this. This table. I hope it's more or less clear. What will be the difference between having G deterministic of random? Well, if G is deterministic, what I obtain is a deterministic algorithm. If G instead is random, what I obtain is a randomized algorithm. Same here. Deterministic algorithm, randomized algorithm. Okay? Now what about F? Well, F has nothing to do with the algorithm. F is given. Is it the system that I am being given to solve? So if F is deterministic, what I have is what we can call worst case analysis. And here the same, worst case analysis. What about randomizing F? Well, this is part of the analysis of an algorithm. As Peter explained in the lecture yesterday, we can put some sort of tiny division here, and we can have either average case, or we can have smooth analysis. Okay? So, let's look a little bit at this table. When you look here, worst case analysis deterministic algorithm, there is very, very little thing we will be able to say, because we are given an F, we have a starting point G, we may know the condition of F and the condition of G, but whatever happens in the middle, God knows. So this is a case that the most one can give is an expression like the expression that Jean-Pierre was giving, saying, well, the number of steps will depend on the, you know, the worst condition you find in the path. Okay, let's leave that one. Worst case analysis randomized algorithm. This has been a, let me put here, no, here. Average case randomized algorithm, sorry. Beltrán Pardo. This is what Carlos and Luismi did a few years ago. They randomized G, they did the average analysis, and they found a given explicit algorithm that works in polynomial, and actually not only in polynomial, in very, very fast time. This here, let me put S17. This is the problem that Steve Smale proposed for the mathematicians of the 21st century as his 17th problem in the list. The idea was to find a deterministic algorithm that will give me, on the average, so for averaging over the data, polynomial time. What else can one say? Worst case analysis randomized algorithm. Well, it would be nice to be able to do something also here, because that would be some sort of condition-based analysis as the one we mentioned on the first two lectures. So without further ado, let me begin telling you some results. First, Beltrán Pardo is a theorem. Let me put BP. It says the following. If you take the expectation over F, I won't say when I want anything, when if I don't write anything, I mean normal, Gaussian, and the expectation over G, Z, the initial pair. This is Gaussian. This is randomly chosen among the Bezout number of zeros of my system. Of the number of steps, this means number of steps of my algorithm here, with endpoint F, an initial pair G zeta, what we obtain is bounded by a constant times capital N. You remember this is the size of my input, the number of coefficients in my polynomial system, little n, d to the 3/2. Okay? This is a very, very fast algorithm. By the way, this is just the number of iterations. After one needs to multiply this number of iterations for the cost of each iteration, and this gives me a total cost on around capital N square. Theorem 1. What we have managed to do is to extend this first result to a smooth analysis. A smooth analysis I will do consider exactly the same, but I will consider the expectation where F is taken from a Gaussian, again, but is centered on a point F bar and has a variance sigma square identity. It's not exactly that, but almost. I'm cheating a little bit here. That is essentially this. Then I will take again my randomized algorithm, G and zeta, and I will consider this number of steps. And what we obtain is that for all F bar with norm of F bar, let's say, equals 1, and all sigma, let's say sigma in the interval 0, 1, these expectations is bounded by constant d 3/2, capital N, little n, just like that, 1 over sigma. Okay, so we extend the average case analysis to a smooth analysis. So we can somehow put randomized here is a smooth analysis. This is theorem 1. We can do a little bit more. Theorem 2. Now we consider an F which is given. F given, any F. And we can consider the randomized algorithm, so G and zeta taking at random, and we can consider the expectation for G over G zeta of this number. We can bound this. And we find something very similar, constant, not d 3/2, but d 3, so a little bit higher the constant on the degree. Capital N, little n, and of course, something will come related with F. And the something that comes is mu max of F squared. Now, let me remind you that mu max square of F is the maximum over the zeros of F of mu norm square F zeta. Okay? So this, without the norm, is a Z condition number that Jean-Pierre mentioned several times in his talk and that was introduced by Mike and Steve in the 90s. And of course, the total time of the algorithm will have to depend on the condition of F. And the worse condition F is, the more time the algorithm will take. But the good news is that there is nothing here about the condition along the path. Okay, so the only condition occurring in this bound is a final one. So that would be randomized worst case analysis, theorem 2. And we can still quote one theorem more, theorem 3, which says the following. We exhibit a deterministic algorithm. So now we move to G on the upper level, so G is not randomized. We exhibit a deterministic algorithm satisfying that the expected value over F, so again F is Gaussian, I am now considering average case, I am on the box that says S17 of the number of steps, okay, let's put number of steps, in the cost, let's say, for F. Here I don't put G zeta because it's deterministic, it's part of the algorithm, is bounded by n to the order of log n. So this is not a solution to Smail 17 problem, because in order to do that we should have a 1 here. We don't have a 1. That is nearly there. Nearly there. Okay? We actually call it an early solution of the 17th problem. Let me say something that I didn't say, and it's extremely important. I am cheating you very badly here in the sense that I am not telling you something which is extremely basic. For this algorithm to work, I said, okay, I'm given an initial G and a zero of G. And I said, okay, the distribution I take is you take your G at random with, you know, the Gaussian or uniform on your projective, the way you want to like the, to look at it, and then you choose a zero uniformly among the zeros of the system. Of course, here there is a problem. This was a problem you wanted to solve in the first place. There is a very, very nice way to do that, and I will not explain it, among other things, because I think Carlos, I begged him to do it, and so he will probably do it this afternoon. So you will see how this can be done. This is one of the great, it's magic in the papers that Carlos and Luis me wrote on this issue. So what is the role of condition? Let me now say, what is the role of condition in this business? Okay?
because we were supposed to talk about conditions.
Well, the paper Bezout 6 that Jean-Pierre mentioned is essential. It's absolutely essential. It is in this paper where this algorithm is hidden. It's not explicit, but it's quite implicit on that paper, so you can uncover it. And in that paper, there is a important result saying that if you get the expectation over the zeros of G of this number of steps of F, G, zeta, these are the zeros of C, okay? Then this expectation is bounded by a certain constant, d to the 3/2, and then the integral between 0 and 1 of mu 2 square q tau d tau. Okay. So let me come back here, and you remember that we mentioned in the first lecture that sometimes you take the best condition solution, sometimes you take the worst condition solution, like in this case, and sometimes you take some sort of average condition solution. That's what mu 2 does. Mu 2 square is 1 divided by d, the sum j equals 1 up to d of mu norm square g zeta j, where those are the zeros of g. Okay? So this condition number, in some sense, is better than this one. So one of the great advances in Bezout 6 was that instead of considering the giving a bound in terms of the worst possible thing that can happen on my path, it gave a bound in terms of the average thing that will happen in my path in two ways. One, we consider this condition number. Second, we average it by integrating. Okay? So, what happens now? What we are interested, that would be Bezout 6. What we are interested is in expectation, taking expectation over S, and then expectation over G. So here will come expectation over F and expectation over G. The next key thing is to realize that, well, let's say F and G are Gaussian. We don't say much more about, because they are always Gaussian. Variances may vary and maybe centered or non-centered, but they are Gaussian. So this parametrization in the fraction of an arc, of an angle, is not too good for Gaussians. So one thing we want to do is we want to change, and we want to use a parametrization in which qt equals 1 minus tg plus tf. So instead of vary with a fraction of an angle, I will vary with a fraction of a segment. If I do that, what I get is that whatever is there on top is smaller or equal than constant times d to the 3/2 times expectation of f expectation of g. And here will come the integral between 0 and 1. And here, cheating. Just a little bit, but it's necessary. I will put a capital N here, and here will come mu 2 square of qt divided norm of qt square dt. Now, why we wanted to do that? Because here is where the magic comes. This function here is positive, so we can swap integrals all around. So I can write this as, now no longer cheating, constant d to the 3/2 integral between, let's put the n outside also, integral between 0 and 1 of the expectation of mu 2 square qt divided qt square dt. And here is the nice thing. When you fix t, when you fix t, qt is Gaussian as well. Because if this is Gaussian and this is Gaussian, qt is Gaussian as well. Let me write this because this is important. Let's assume that f is taken from a Gaussian f bar sigma f square identity, and g is taken from another Gaussian g bar sigma g square identity. When we do that, qt is taken from a Gaussian qt bar sigma t square, I don't write the identity, where qt bar is 1 minus t g bar plus t f bar, and sigma t square is 1 minus t square sigma g square plus t square sigma f square, which means we have reached a situation in which, what do we have in here? What do we need to analyze? Let me just make this box. Is this expectation? And what's this expectation? It's simply a smooth analysis, because I will be centered in this QT bar, a smooth analysis of something which is roughly a condition number. It's simply a condition number that has been scaled down by this norm square. And with that, I am reaching my time limit, and I pass you to Peter. Oh, yes.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah. So I took the stick and I will continue here. Now I will talk a little bit about the proof techniques, how can we bound this. So we have one main technical result that I would like to write over there, and then just discuss the main ideas. So I will write it here. Main technical result, just let me write it and then I will put up the board. So I fix any q bar in HD in the sigma between 0 and 1, and I want to do a smooth analysis of this quantity closely related to our condition number. So I have expectation of mu 2 squared q divided by the norm of q squared when q is Gaussian, yeah, but non-centered. Q is Gaussian, the center is q bar, it's isotropic and the variance is sigma square. And the claim is that one can bound this by some constant, small n, number of variables, divided by sigma square. Okay, so that's the main technical result. So I put it up so you can see it. Okay, and let's believe that this is okay. So how can we proceed here if this is actually the case? So then we can bound this here by some constant, small n, and then we have the integral from 0 to 1, 1 over the square of the variance. But Felipe, he wrote here the variance of the random variable we're interested here. Well, this we can assume to be 1, okay? And the f will be, well, this we just denote sigma, okay, to simplify notation. So I have this here, 1 minus t square plus t square sigma square dt. Yeah. Thanks to a comment by Jean-Pierre, Well, our bound was not optimal, but he noticed that one can improve here a little bit. We made something very silly here. So if you tie this into maple, then you get that this is pi over 2 sigma. So you get, indeed, the overall bound sum constant, capital N, small n, divided by sigma. So the sigma square goes away, and you end up with the sigma. And that's d to the 3 half, sorry. Okay. So now, what can we do about this technical lemma? So let me explain you some of the ideas. So we have to go back to our geometric situation. Let me first write a solution variety. It has been around all the time, but we do some little modification here. Namely, it's important to take a completely affine viewpoint. So the solution variety is the set of pairs Q zeta in HT times, here I don't write projective space, but the sphere over the vector space Tn plus 1, which I just denote by Sn. Okay. In Jean-Pierre's lectures, we had here projective space, here projective space, but it's very important to take this affine viewpoint. This looks like a very small step, but I think in all these developments, it was an important psychological barrier to overcome. Because if you want to, if you think in terms of Gaussians, the lengths of these elements actually matter. And if you go to this setting, you kind of lose some property. You have this wonderful invariance. You can think projectively. This is, from the geometrical point of view, wonderful. But if you go to this probabilistic analysis, it's also a kind of, you have to give up it. On the other hand, you gain something. So that's important. Okay, then I will, this is the solution variety, and then I look at the manifold W. This is just the solution variety in the special case where all these degrees di are 1. Okay, so it's the set of pairs m, zeta, m, where in m is an n by n plus 1 matrix, zeta is in this sphere, m of zeta equals 0. So let me denote this space by script m. Yeah? Good. And how are these things connected? I have a map. Maybe I can write it. There is a board left. Yes, it is. So let me put a diagram here. So here I have v. Here I have w. And these things come with projections. So actually the V is a vector bundle where the base space is this here. I have this projection pi 2. Oh, I just mapped the pair Q zeta to the zeta. Familiar situation, but I also have a projection pi 1 to HD. Okay? Familiar situation. Here analogous, a projection P 2. Mapping the pair m zeta to zeta, the projection p1 mapping to the set m. Okay? So, now I come up with a map going from here to here. I denote it psi. And what does psi do? Well, okay, this is m zeta, and m is just the usual thing that we encountered it all the time in these lectures in this week. It's essentially the derivative of q at zeta with a suitable normalization. Okay, so. Right. So this is this map. And actually it's a map of fiber bundles. So now, in order to proceed with our analysis, we need to think in terms of probability distributions. So you remember, on this space here, we have a non-center Gaussian distribution. The center is Q bar, variance is sigma square. Okay? Starting from this distribution here, I'm going to define a probability distribution here. In a very very simple way. The idea is just, first, you choose the cue, okay, like Felipe told you before, and then we choose one of the Bezout number many roots of Q uniformly at random. Okay. Now, a little technical difficulty, because the root will not be now in the projective space, but, you know, in this sphere. So I still have the possibility of choose one of the angles. Okay. This I just do uniformly. Then I end up with a probability distribution here. Okay. Maybe I should write this. Yeah. Oh, no. Yeah, okay, maybe. Define probability distribution on V. One, choose Q in, okay, then I choose root or zero theta uniformly at random. Among the Bezout number many roots, or zeros. And third step is quite unimportant. Then I actually choose a representative, also uniformly at random. So I mean, I choose as the uniform distribution S1. Okay. So, don't have so much time, so shouldn't write so much. Well, in the special case, there is a special case that Beltrán and Pardo considered. This is a special case where the Q bar is zero and you may take sigma equals one. And this you have when you do average analysis. And then they exactly looked at this probability distribution on V, and then as Felipe just told you, the important insight is that you can actually efficiently sample in this special case. Yeah. Essentially by turning around the roles. I mean, you first choose the root and then you choose the system. Okay, but let's continue with this idea. Let's go back to the general situation where we start here with a non-center Gaussian. So what can we do? So, I think, Felipe, I think I have to erase one of these. Oh no, I go here. Okay, so I have this expectation of this quantity. Over, I just write HD, but here I mean this non-centered Gaussian. Now it's important to notice that, I mean, what is this? Well, okay, I have to go one step further, okay? This, by our definition of the probability distribution on V, I can write this in the following way. This is the expectation over mu norm squared q zeta divided by the norm of q squared. This is just the way we defined the mu 2 squared. It's just an averaging over all the roots. So this is basically by definition of our distribution on V. Nothing else. Okay? So we went from here, we went up to here. Okay, but now we notice by the definition of this condition number mu norm, this is just the same as, okay, the square of the spectral norm of M. Okay, that's, if you remember, I mean, those that remember the definition of mu norm, that's what it is. Okay, so now we are in a comfortable situation. We take the expectation over V of a quantity that only depends on the image of psi. Okay? So we just look, I mean, we have a probability distribution here. It defines a push forward distribution here. Okay? So this can be written now as an expectation over the push forward distribution on W M dagger squared norm. Okay. This only depends on the projection here. So what we may go one step further and say this distribution here defines the distribution here. Okay, let's do it and write this and see whether it helps. Good. Now, special case, going back to the Beltrán-Pardo situation, you remember, average analysis. There, it turns out that the distribution that you obtain here in the special case is actually the standard Gaussian distribution. You are in the nicest of all worlds, and then you just go to the literature, and there is a result by Cheng and Tongarra which extended the Edelman result. You know, the Edelman result gave the average analysis for the square matrices. Here we have an n times n plus 1 matrix. You go to that paper, and then you see this is O over n. In a special case, you are done, I mean, given the other developments. Okay? Good. But now we have to do something more complicated. Our starting distribution here is not centered. So we get something tweaked here. So we have to understand this. I mean, we should not look here. It's not nice. We should not look here. It's also not so nice. So what should we do? Actually, it turns out you have to look at the fibers of P2. Okay? So let's forget about this. This is maybe not a good way to go, but we do something else. I mean, we think like probabilists, and we want to compute this expectation as an iterated expectation. We have an expectation here over the base point theta, and then conditional expectation in the fiber, whatever this means. So the fiber is denoted this, so maybe I should write here, okay, m index theta is the fiber of theta under the projection P2, which consists of the matrices that such that n theta equals 0. So this is actually isomorphic to z to the n times n. So you may think of it as square matrices. Okay, so you take the expectation here of this. Okay, but now it's essentially inverse of a square matrix. But this is a conditional distribution. Conditional distribution. So how should I write it? We have some conditional density here, which I denote by, well, rho tilde m zeta. So, okay, whatever this is. It is conditional. I mean, in order to make, okay. I mean, you all know, I think, these iterated expectations, but this situation is a bit special in the sense that we have manifolds here. So we have, there is the coarea formula coming in, and there are some complications. Okay? But if you know the coarea formula, it's quite straightforward. So one needs to define what this actually means. But intuitively, I think it's quite clear. Now, the point is, We need to recover. We need to find some distributions that we know so that we can prove something. And the point is, this conditional distribution on the fibers is quite nice. It's not Gaussian, but very closely related to a Gaussian. Okay. The following turns out to be the case. This I cannot. Okay, I see. Right. So if you go through the calculations, then we find the conditional density rho tilde of n zeta in the fiber satisfies. Okay. It's still above the red thing. So. Okay, this is some normalizing constant times determinant of m star times the density of a Gaussian. Okay, this is of course very good news. Okay, this is Gaussian. Of course, it will not be centered, but we don't care because we all want to do smooth analysis anyway. So, how is my time? A few minutes left. Maybe. So, almost, yeah. So how do we get this Gaussian? Yeah? Maybe. Very briefly. Well, let's assume we fix zeta. Then it turns out that you have a vector space decomposition of HD, kind of a constant part, a linear part, and the remainder part, orthogonal. Okay, so this decomposition also occurs in a, well, maybe I should acknowledge there was a paper by Luismi and Carlos, the third paper they wrote in this setting. There are a couple of very important ideas for this development. So it was very important. One thing was that this map, if you don't do the scaling here, if you don't have this, you get a map where the normal Jacobian is constant. So this indicates that there is a nice direct waveform going to here to here. Okay, and this decomposition also already appeared earlier. That's okay. Anyway, you have this orthogonal decomposition. I don't have time to define it, but it doesn't matter. But you see, our Gaussian has a center Q bar. And once you fix the zeta, then you can decompose. Okay? Okay, it's just a decomposition. You don't even have to look at the letters. But what is also important is that this linear part occurring here is actually isomorphic to the fiber. Isometric. So what you get here, this part, here in the linear part, so corresponds to some matrix here. And this matrix is the mean of this Gaussian. So this is the procedure. Okay, almost done. Now you see what you have to do. We are left with a smooth analysis of a matrix. It's even a square matrix, no? Basically. So, okay, now you can look at the bag of tricks that is available, and there are different tricks. First, we did something, and then we realized one can even do better. So if you go to a paper by Sankar, Spielmann, and Teng, they have a nice box of tricks. I don't go to Mario Schäfer's paper. And you see, the ideas they have just carry over. I mean, this is just a slight modification of a Gaussian. And you prove, what you actually prove is the following. This thing here, you fix a zeta. And then you bound this by O of n over sigma squared. Okay? But this is for any root zeta. So you get it. And that's what I want to prove. So, thank you.